the age of 19 in 1962, she was an intern at the White House, and apparently wound up taking a little private tour of JFK and getting a little look at Jackie's bedroom, particularly, which is supposed to be a baby blue room that she had painted and redone during the redecoration stuff over there. And that's where they had sex one time. They had sex in the swimming pool, and they had sex in there in third place. And, oh, she thinks she was special. I'm very sure that he was going to stay with his wife and all, but I was still special, even though, you know, I was whatever, and I wasn't the kind of girl who was a bad girl, but I became a bad girl because JFK influenced me. And, dear, dear Lord, what a dirty, dirty old man. At one point, she says that, I think in the beginning she was introduced to him, like Dave Powers kind of, you know, put the introduction together and had her go swimming with him. And then later on, she tells a story about how Kennedy wants her to blow Dave Powers, who was, you know, this more straight-laced special assistant. You know, hey, go help my friend relax, this kind of stuff. This was pretty interesting viewing. We have all these situations. I'd love to know why it takes 50 years, you know, for a 19-year-old girl to eventually get up the gumption to put these things out.
All right, and we are live. This is the Ocelli Effect. I am Chuck Ocelli, also known as the Blind JFK Researcher in some circles. And this is the first live broadcast of my show. Happy Susan B. Anthony Day to all of you out there. So for our first episode, I have decided to bring on one of the best authors I've ever been in contact with in any way, shape, or form to expound upon somebody that did what most of us really are trying to do in our own personal lives on a daily basis. We all fight the system in some way or other, the people that are involved in this network. We all have our arguments with the system, and we often focus on the officers of many courts who are doing the misdeeds that cause all types of malfeasance to be present throughout the criminal justice system. But today, my focus is going to be more on someone who was a true patriot, a gentleman that many, many people, unfortunately, have only learned about through people like Oliver Stone and the movie JFK, which was based on the life and times, in some measure, of Jim Garrison, who was the district attorney of New Orleans, at the time of the assassination. It's a great story, and although you see that film panned in many places as a fictional portrayal and a fantasy and everything else, very much of that film was real. And Jim Garrison was a real person who, in his position, stood up to the system. And the reason why? Well, we're going to learn a lot about that today with, again, one of my favorite authors, Joan Mellon, who recently it's a reissue, but it's an updated version of one of my favorite books that she authored called A Farewell to Justice, which was all about Garrison and his attempt and his actual accomplishment of bringing the only criminal prosecution ever for the assassination of our 35th president. Joan, thank you very much for joining me today. How are you?
Hi, Chuck. Good to hear you. Good luck on your show. And I'm glad to be on to talk about Jim Garrison. I wonder if he really thought that he was fighting the system. He knew he was, but the only thing he wanted was to find out the truth about what happened to President Kennedy. That was his mission. It wasn't that this was an example or an aspect of how he felt about the system. He learned about the system through trying to find out the truth about what happened when President Kennedy was murdered.
Yeah, he was a true believer in the system. As a matter of fact, prior to that, he was someone who had served in wartime in a very dangerous position during World War II. He was really a patriotic individual that believed in this country, the principles that it was founded on, absolutely, completely. And he was definitely not the man that they have attempted to slander in the mainstream media, especially at the time Stone's film was released. And I think that that's what I mean by he was a guy who was fighting the system, because when he found the truth, he had found that there was a big problem in the system, and he stood up with a lot of courage, despite the fact that he was often threatened. He went out there and publicly and in his own capacity, again, as the district attorney there in New Orleans, did what he could to bring about the truth and justice in this case.
He did a lot. And one of the, I think the best document that I discovered after the publication of A Farewell to Justice was one from the CIA's History Review Group, which was an internal document not meant for being shown to anyone outside the agency, which admitted that what Garrison surmised but couldn't prove was in fact true. And it says that the records reveal that Clay Shaw was a highly paid CIA contract source. Highly paid CIA contract source. Now, the sentence adds until 1956. But there's another CIA document that is more honest and traces Shaw's service to 1972, which is much more to the point. And I think that what Garrison struggled to prove, unfortunately, came years after his death. But it shows that he certainly deserves a kind of respect that he still hasn't gotten, not in the so-called research community, certainly not in the media, mass media, any kind of media. And I think you'd very rarely hear his name on cable television or network television or at assassination meetings unless I'm there or Oliver Stone is there or the few people who support the Garrison work, like Dick Russell, Jim Mars, very few people even want to talk about Garrison.
Yeah, and, you know, the fascinating thing to me has always been that, and by the way, for those who don't know out there, just because, you know, I'm not sure of the level of awareness people have or if they've watched the film, you know, in my audience right now. But just to catch you guys up to speed a little bit, Clay Shaw was the individual that was played by Tommy Lee Jones in the JFK movie. And he was the suspect that Garrison ended up with and actually took to trial. And many of the mainstream historians and even people in the research community who claim that they are in search of the truth often cite the fact that Shaw was acquitted for the murder, for the conspiracy. But the fact is that even in the CIA's own documents as they exist, and those documents were a lot of them made public after the outcry from the JFK film, just in case our listeners aren't aware of this, those documents themselves in some cases prove that the Central Intelligence Agency and other agencies within our own government directly interfered in the investigation, in the trial, so that, you know, the guy was hamstrung by the government that was supposed to be there protecting our president, was supposed to be there and claiming that it was just this lone nut Oswald who had gone off and done it by himself. And it's almost 50 years now since the Warren Commission report was issued. It's been the 50-year anniversary just went by of the assassination. But 50 years after that lie was published, they are still in denial over the truth about what happened. And Garrison came very close to it, despite the fact that he had been hindered by the very government he was attempting to serve.
Well, he was attempting to serve the truth about what happened to President Kennedy. I don't think he felt that he was serving the government. He was serving his constituents. He was serving the people of Orleans Parish. And he was serving the truth about what happened here to President Kennedy. I don't think it was very early on that he, you know, he made a joke of law enforcement, because what happened to his investigators in New Orleans was that while they, in previous cases, in most of their cases, they had help from other agencies of law enforcement, such as the FBI. In the case of the Kennedy assassination, the FBI obstructed them and did surveillance on their office, follow their investigators and generally put out the view, as Hoover put it down to the special agents at the field offices, that Garrison was, quote, a nut. This was Hoover's standard procedure for inconvenient witnesses. He said the same thing about Sylvia Odio, who witnessed whom Oswald visited, calling himself Leon Oswald, with Angelo Morgado and Bernardo de Torres at the end of September in 1963. And just to refresh the audience memory, if you don't know about the incident, these three people, two of them were Cuban, and they came there supposedly collecting funds for their organization or whatever. And then a day or two later, one of them, Bernardo de Torres, called himself Leopoldo, told Sylvia Odio, you know that Leon Oswald, he keeps talking about how some Cubans should kill President Kennedy because of what he did, his abandonment of the people at the Bay of Pigs, which he did do. He did abandon the people at the Bay of Pigs. And so Sylvia Odio, who was so terrified, she did testify that she saw Oswald, but was very reluctant to, and never, I think she's still alive, never has identified the two Cubans who came to her door. But that was very hard work that I did. I did that. Nobody wants to believe me. I think it's very funny that, Chuck, you should mention that today is Susan B. Anthony Day. Because I think, I never think about this, but lately I've been thinking about whether a woman researcher in this field gets the same level of respect and is taken as seriously as the men. No matter what the research is, no matter what you've done, there's that shadow, that cloud over being a woman, because I can't understand why people have not embraced this research in particular about who visited Sylvia Odio. And I'm absolutely positive, because I met one of them, that's Angelo Morgado, and he told me that it was Bernardo de Torres who was with him. And he looked at me, and he was staring into the middle distance, sort of, as if he were talking to himself. And he was trying to blame, he loved the Kennedys. He changed his name even to Angelo Kennedy. He loved the Kennedys, and here he is somehow participating in a frame-up and a lead-up to the assassination of President Kennedy. He was horrified by this, and he just sat there looking. It's years and years later, after all. This was in the 1990s, or was it in the 2000s? I can't recall when that interview was. It's in the book. But he just stood and stared into the middle distance and said, but his brother was running for mayor of Miami, meaning that Bernardo de Torres was respectable, that there was no reason to doubt him, that he would be involved in something so heinous a crime as the assassination of President Kennedy. And I first heard that. I didn't believe it. I heard it in 1999 when I was interviewing a soldier of fortune, was very close to these events, named Gerald Patrick Hemming. And, of course, Hemming mixed the truth with the lies, and so you can't take any. I didn't take anything that he said at face value without verifying it with others. And the first minute I walked into his house, it was in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and he said, you know, the only person I fear, now, of course, you never fear anyone, the only person I fear is Bernie. He didn't even give me his whole name, Bernie. And then he said, and then there was also Angelo. And I said, at that point, this is several years before I met Angelo Morgado, I said, he said, and Angela. I said, Angelo who? Just Angelo, he said. And he dropped those truths in the midst of all sorts of other conversation about his own deal, his own problems with the Drug Enforcement Agency, which is, of course, I have learned since, is a pseudonym for CIA, and other things. And then years later, I discovered, and he introduced me to Angelo Morgado. I got to his house. I had dinner there, and we talked. And that was very big for me, because Angelo told me, and this is sort of a little digression, but it talks to how the research is done on these, how difficult the research is. So Angelo told me that he had been sent with a group of Cubans to New Orleans during the summer of 1963. And since Oswald, who was in New Orleans during the summer of 1963, was training at Lake Pontchartrain with anti-Castro Cubans, naturally, Angelo and his group became aware of Oswald. And they went back to Bobby Kennedy, and they said, you know, there's this Oswald. And they also discovered Oswald's relationship with the New Orleans, the field office of the FBI in New Orleans, and Oswald's handler was Warren DeBruys, whom I got to know quite well also, died just a few weeks ago. And Bobby Kennedy said, well, if the FBI has him under control, we don't have to worry. Now, that's a quite understandable mistake, and it just shows the lack of communication between the agencies and how close Bobby Kennedy came to the plot regarding his brother, because this business at Sylvia Odio's, after all, was part of the framing of Oswald.
Right.
And occurred in September.
Right, and a couple of little catch-ups for our audience here. Sylvia Odio, to put her in proper context, was the daughter of a Cuban person who her father, let me restate that, her father was, at the time that this was occurring, in prison, I believe, in Cuba, because he had stood up in some way or had been considered a subversive by Castro's government. And these guys that you're talking about approaching her were the two Cubans and this Oswald character, which to this day, in my mind, it's very difficult to discern, because I didn't get to speak to these guys that you're talking about myself. But it's very difficult to discern whether it was actually Oswald or if it was simply part of a cover story where somebody was using the name Oswald. I had trouble with that myself. You might be able to shed some light on it.
Well, I think, Chuck, that you have to – I'm going to go by Sylvia Odio's own identification, that when Oswald was arrested in Dallas for the murder of President Kennedy and she saw him on television, she actually fainted. And that's the man, that's the person who came to see her.
Right.
So what better identification, what more could you need? It was Oswald, all right. And if the very fact that Angelo Morgado had known him already before in the summer of 1963 in New Orleans also suggests it was Oswald. Bernardo de Torres was the person who was going to be at Dealey Plaza. And this, of course, I can't prove, because I couldn't talk to Bernardo de Torres. He had been out of the country. And then he has returned to Miami, but I was told that he requires money to talk to researchers or interviewers. And that's just against the principle of independent research, is to pay people for talking. And so not a single person. I interviewed more than 1,000 people over the 7, 8 years that I did Farewell to Justice, and I didn't give a nickel to one of them. Because that's just not what you're supposed to do. So
right.
You might have had dinner here and there, but nobody was ever paid. So, and of course, Bernardo de Torres never talked to anyone. And when he talked to, by the way, he did talk to the House Select Committee on assassinations. And the most marvelous commentary came from the chief investigator out of Miami for the House Select Committee, Gayton Fonzie. And I love Fonzie's remark, because he was sitting in, and the background for De Torres' testimony before the HSCA was that the FBI came in the morning and mentioned certain dates about which they were not to talk to, they were not to ask him questions. And then the CIA came in and gave their dates for when a period of time when the lawyers of the House Select Committee were not to ask Bernardo de Torres any questions. And so Gayton Fonzie, listening to all this, what Bernardo de Torres finally said, to listen to him, you would never think that of all the 100,000 or whatever Cubans that were in Miami, why they should pick this guy to question.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really so succinct and so marvelous. And I recommend, by the way, there's a new reissue of Gayton Fonzie's book,
The Last Investigation.
And I just wanted to call that to people's attention. I believe it was published by the Mary Farrell Foundation under the auspices of the marvelous leader of that group, Rex Bradford.
Right. And I read the original version of the book myself. I haven't read the updated version. But I've got to tell you that a couple of points I want to make to my listeners here. First of all, listen to what Joan is saying about doing the independent research. She's not trusting mere hearsay. She went out and spoke to people directly. When you want to know someone's perspective, you have to go to them, find out from them directly. You can't simply accept hearsay evidence. And also, even though she was speaking to someone, she didn't absolutely take their word for it. She found other corroboration for these things. And I think that this is something to be taken note of by many, many people who don't follow this type of ethical sort of pattern when it comes to their own writings and things, and they allow a lot of speculation to interfere with the very good facts that they could uncover. That's one.
If I might mention, underlining your point, I might mention a recent book about the Kennedy assassination by Roger Stone. And this is one of the chain of books. There have been book after book after book, year after year, saying that Lyndon Johnson was really the organizer and plotter of the Kennedy assassination, with his lawyer or his factotum on the ground, Cliff Carter, and so forth. And if you look at that book, you will not find a shred of evidence for any of its assertions.
And I'm so glad that you're mentioning that, because I was going to bring it up with you and ask you to just expound upon this entire, genre of LBJ did it stuff that I started to see come to fruition, really, with the first airing of a very poorly done The Men Who Killed Kennedy episode, which featured Barr McClellan. And that's where that stuff really started to blossom. There had always been the idea floating around that Lyndon Johnson had something to do with the assassination. And the idea that he might have been informed of it ahead of time is very possible. But there are books out there that literally describe him as a mastermind behind it. And these books are, in some cases, getting a lot of airplay in the alternative media and elsewhere. And they don't deserve it, because once you pull a few assertions out of them, the entire house of cards collapses. They're no better than the official lies that are out there. And the House Select Committee, by the way, in case people don't know this, was the congressional body that was put together in the mid-1970s and did investigate the Kennedy assassination in addition to the Martin Luther King Jr. assassination. And both of them found at the end, regardless of the controversy and the troubles with their investigations, both of them actually found that there was a likely conspiracy in both of these cases. So understand that when they point to the Warren Commission, by the way, and they say to you, look, it's just the lone nut, it's just the lone nut. Even the HSTA, which there are many problems with, including the fact that they claim that Oswald was certainly an assassin that day, they also do reflect the idea that there was a conspiracy. Now, I want to go further on this Lyndon Johnson thing, and I'm, again, so glad you brought it up. But there was one other thought, and I didn't want to lose it on Garrison, that even outside of the Kennedy assassination, he had won a decision in the United States Supreme Court where he had been given he had actually had to take this before many judges, before many bodies, when he was criticizing public officials, and they tried to pillory him for this in the media and in the court system, and he won that case in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, to give some background about that, let me give a little background of that. It wasn't
Thank
what
you.
Happened was that the judges of the criminal court in Orleans Parish were very annoyed with Garrison because he was using money from the fees that were people defaulting on bail and so forth, and he was using that money to fix up his office and so forth. And so Garrison was furious, and he went and said that the judges on the criminal court were like the sacred cows of India, and that they were never at work. They celebrated all kinds of holidays, including, he made up a few, like Huey Long's birthday and St. Winterbottom's Day and so forth. Mm. And he also said that they were mafia connected. So for all those people that are still saying, like Peter Dale Scott, that Garrison was fronting for the mafia, here's Garrison in court saying, well, not yet in court, but in public, saying that the judges, and they were, and he could prove it, Frank Costello was involved in one of them, connected to the mafia. So the judges got very angry at this, and they met en banc, that means all of them together, and they sued Garrison in court for criminal libel. And Garrison had to defend himself. He got a wonderful lawyer named Don Organ, and who didn't charge a cent. And Garrison lost. The judges won. And then he went on appeal, and he lost again. And then his lawyer took him. They went to the United States Supreme Court, and they were very fortunate because New York Times versus Sullivan had already been passed. And that gave newspapers the right to criticize unless you could show malice. And the Garrison case, which was Garrison versus Louisiana, was an addendum to that and said that you had the freedom, it underlined the freedom to criticize public officials. The opinion was written by William Brennan, Justice Brennan, who is, of course, we know, the most liberal member of the Supreme Court, and there are no William Brennans today, not even a shadow of a William.
Not even, yeah, remotely, not even.
And, yeah, and so Garrison won that case. It was a great victory for him. And this is all before anything about Kennedy assassination. It hadn't, there was nothing about, I think it was earlier.
Oh,
so
no.
The other thing is that Garrison was very concerned about civil liberties throughout his years as District Attorney of Orleans Parish. And he often said the freedom of speech needs to be in an oxygen tent, that it always needs to be fortified because you can always lose it. And he fought against the police in New Orleans, censored a book by James Baldwin called, was it Another Country? No, I can't remember.
I believe so. They,
James Baldwin was confiscated from the Doubleday bookstore, Garrison opposed that. He fought against the prevalent racism, and there were Klan bombings throughout New Orleans.
Oh, this was going to be my next point. Yeah,
of his in the early years that he was a district attorney, and he pursued them. He also refused to prosecute homosexuals who were regularly arrested. And on what they called crimes against nature.
Yep.
And Garrison said the only crimes against nature are hurricanes, cyclones, and all this, and made a joke of it. And nobody was allowed to prosecute. None of his assistants were allowed to prosecute people on so-called crimes against nature. And in fact, when Garrison put Clay Shaw on trial for participation in the conspiracy to murder President Kennedy, and that doesn't mean that that was the conspiracy that ultimately resulted in the assassination, but that Shaw was part of a conspiracy to murder President Kennedy, and one that involved Oswald, the person who was allegedly the killer. Garrison made sure that Shaw's homosexuality was never mentioned in court during the trial or any of the pretrial hearings, and not only that, he didn't call to testify any of the homosexual friends of Shaw. People were, why not Raymond Brochiers, and why not, and so on. And Garrison just would not do that. I thought he took a principled stand. He also, by the way, as a side note, at this trial of Clay Shaw, he also refused to call anyone with a criminal record. And that was a problem.
It's an error, yeah.
Like Tate Dago Garner and others who knew a lot about certainly the relationship between Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby would have been good witnesses, but he was determined that the witnesses not be be undermined or by Shaw's defense on the ground that they had committed felonies.
Right. He didn't want the character of the witnesses to be brought to issue in the courtroom, during a time when the content of what they had to say was the most important thing. He didn't want the jury, the public, or even the record to be, sort of distracted from the real issues. And the idea here, the reason why I brought it up is because I wanted to add a little bit more texture to the idea of who this guy is, because so often you see authors all the way from then, which was in the late 60s when the Shaw trial ended in 1969, all the way from then till now, people have discussed how the guy was compromised and he was crazy and he had no principles and he was just a publicity hound that really didn't have, and all these terrible, nasty criticisms of the guy who was a completely legitimate stand-up person, who was by no means a screaming radical of any kind. He was just a fair-minded person who was in search of the truth and in search of justice. And I think that these types of things that we're talking about here are worth mentioning for that reason. I don't know what you think about that, but I'm pretty sure you agree with me here.
Well, and, of course. I think that Garrison has an impeccable record on civil liberties, on racism. He often said somebody asked him, I think Richard Billings was from Life magazine, came down to the office, and Billings asked Garrison, this is something for Northerners and us in the East, hard to understand, what is the Sovereignty Commission? The Sovereignty Commission was the state organization set up by the state of Louisiana and Mississippi to prevent integration. And so Garrison would joke, and he said, well, what the Sovereignty Commission means, they don't want black people to walk on Royal Street. He was joking. But there's a marvelous documentary, by the way, about the Sovereignty Commission that PBS put out this year, and you can really see how they infiltrated the civil rights movement. And especially how the people who were Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney, who were murdered during Mississippi summer in 1964, how their movements were charted by spies from the Sovereignty Commission that infiltrated the movement. There were also spies from the NAACP.
That was the story that was dramatized in the movie Mississippi Burning. Yeah. That was the that's where a lot of people might recall those names in case they had not studied the struggle of this.
I agree that people, you should look and see the people who are involved in these cases and in all this history. You want to see if they look for notoriety. And if they do look for notoriety, you tend to look at their testimony and perhaps hesitate before accepting it. And one of the people in A Farewell to Justice who was a CIA asset and was involved here as a possible patsy, Thomas Edward Beckham. And, oh, boy, I and also, of course, his handler, Jack Martin, he was the CIA. I think I prove in the new update to my book, that Jack Martin was certainly connected to CIA. But Thomas Edward Beckham, oh, boy, because he gave such frank testimony to me when I interviewed him in Louisville. And Thomas Edward Beckham had been a few years earlier represented when he was a lawyer by a judge in Alabama called Charles McKnight, who befriended Beckham. And when he read my book, he was very interested because he said to me, you know, the guy was so intelligent without an education, no education. I mean, not even elementary school. And so smart. And he liked him so much. And he wanted to, when he represented him, suddenly his office was robbed and all the files were taken. And he called the FBI, said, would you find this guy for me? Because Beckham had disappeared into the hinterland. And the FBI agent came back and said, he doesn't exist. I can't find anything about him. This was already in the 1980s. And a year or so ago, Charlie McKnight called me and he said, do you have Beckham's phone number? Because he's still, all these years later, it just kind of had an affectionate feeling for Beckham. And so I did. I managed to find his phone number, miracle. And McKnight called him up and Beckham answered. And he said, you have the wrong number. I don't know anybody there's nobody here by that name. So he didn't want any attention. He was terrified, really, of being, of the consequences of having been so close a witness to the Kennedy assassination. And when I first called in, the question that he asked me was, is Jack Martin still alive? Jack Martin frightened him. So to those who think that Jack Martin was just a drunk who hung around Guy Bannister's office, we can talk about Guy Bannister if you like in a minute, really was a hapless figure, was a religious fanatic belonging to some extraterrestrial churches and of no consequence. It was very interesting to hear Thomas Edward Beckham saying that fearing even these years later, Jack Martin. Jack Martin was dead, and luckily for me, that allowed Beckham really to talk to me, and so I went to Louisville and talked to him. There are so many, and put some update in the update to A Farewell to Justice. I put some more information about Beckham, and also about another of his handlers, whose name was Fred Lee Chrisman. And who also appeared before the Orleans Parish grand jury. But by that time, Garrison was exhausted. It was almost time for the Shaw trial, and Chrisman just talked his way out of it. These are people who have no scruples about lying to a grand jury. The idea that you don't lie to the grand jury is some fantasy out of the 19th century, I think. We see also just as a slight digression, because you brought it up, Chuck, and that is in the case with the Lyndon Johnson story, Billy Saul Estes, who is the only witness who says anything about Lyndon Johnson and a young man named Mack Wallace being involved in murders. And Billy Saul Estes, when he got out of prison, a second stretch of, in prison, went before the grand jury in Robertson County and started accusing Johnson and Mack Wallace and so forth about planning murders and whatnot. And the idea that on that you mentioned that episode of The Men Who Killed Kennedy, which had to do with the Lyndon Johnson story, fatuous comment by one of the so-called researchers who said, well, there's no reason why Billy Saul Estes would lie.
Except for the fact that he was an admitted con man.
He admitted he was a liar. He went in on the second trial. He stood before the jury, and he said, I'm a liar, and I exaggerate, and I brag. Those were the things. And he admitted, you know, as if he were trying to disarm the jury with all of that. And to use him as a witness for anything, I mean, this would not hold up in any court of law, and it shouldn't hold up in the court of history. Now, history allows hearsay, if you have to have it, in a way that a court of law doesn't. But it has to be presented, I think, with a caveat. And the caveat is this is hearsay. We only such and such witness said it, so and so claims. But in the case of Billy Saul Estes, I also have come to believe that he himself was implicated in one or more of the murders that he accuses Mack Wallace of having committed.
Right.
So it's a mess. And this is the only evidence, getting back to what we were talking about before, about the Lyndon Johnson did it a story. This is the only evidence. And if you call it, and it's not evidence, the only thing that they could point to. Now, I want to go back, if I may, to the whole issue of how this happened. This Lyndon Johnson did it book after book, year after year, whether it's Barr McClellan, whether it's Roger Stone, whether it's the Men on the Sixth Floor, there are a whole bunch of those books. And Phil Nelson is another one, many of them.
Right, and it's a great study in how quite often these distractions are sort of propagated by certain individuals who really just want to give you something to keep you away from the truth. And I think the linchpin in all of those terrible stories that have come out that are just absolutely based in nothing, the linchpin has been for these people that, well, Mack Wallace was there that day, and the reason is they have this particular piece of evidence, and you and I had discussed this nowhere on the air anywhere, but I know what it is that we're talking about here, and I really would love to have you talk about that as well. So please, let's not forget to mention that one piece of evidence and what it is.
I want to talk about where this comes from in general. That is the historical overview of the Lyndon Johnson did it. And I think that what we have found, Jim Garrison, of course, set us on the path to looking at CIA in particular, but also other intelligence agencies cooperating in plotting the assassination. And Garrison, of course, and this has been said many times by me and others, didn't care who the shooters were. What he cared about was whose idea this was, who was the plotter. Hmm. And CIA, as I've said many times, others have seen it, put out a document in April 1967, in which was directed to the CIA's media assets, directing on how to counter the criticisms of various critics. Mark Lane was one, and Jim Garrison, whose name is not in the document, was really the main subject, because that document was issued at the time of the Garrison investigation in 1967. And So what did CIA do? In order to instruct its media assets, one thing was to accuse Garrison of being the dupe of the KGB and of Moscow. And in that case, they particularly set their media assets onto the Paese Sera, which is an Italian newspaper that just at the time that Clay Shaw was arrested in March 1967, March 1st, Paese Sera put out a series of articles about a CIA front organization in Europe called Permindex, with a special sidebar organization in Rome called Centro Commerciale Mondiale. I think I have that right. Anyway, so Clay Shaw was a director of that organization. So here he is being the director of a CIA front organization at the time, on the board of directors, at the time that Garrison is looking into exactly what Shaw's CIA connections were. Well, what was CIA then going to do and tell its media assets? After a little bit of time went by, they decided to put forth the view that the mafia did it. It was really a mafia plan and not at all CIA. And in that respect, they had several writers. One of them was John Davis, who published a book called Mafia Kingfish. He was a cousin of Jacqueline Kennedy. And another book was the book that was published by Robert Blakey, co-authored with Richard Billings. Now, Blakey was the head of the chief counsel of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and CIA was deeply involved in manipulating and controlling the House Select Committee. And I have in A Farewell to Justice a lot of the correspondence between Scott Breckinridge of CIA and Blakey, as CIA looked at the questions that were being asked of people, edited the report that HSCA wrote, and so forth. Okay, so the years went by, and we have another of those books called Ultimate Sacrifice. And that book came out very coincidentally, exactly at the same moment that my book came out. So if I was going to say that Garrison was right and the CIA was behind the assassination in some way, here's the book by Lamar Waldron and a radio personality named Tom Hartman saying, no, no, here's the mafia right there. Well, years went by, and this mafia done it idea sort of wore thin, and people began to ask, how could the mafia have orchestrated the cover-up? They might have been involved. They were involved with CIA, my goodness, since 1946 and 47, when they involved themselves in Operation Gladio in Italy, before even the ink was dry on CIA charter. We could talk about that, because to know history of CIA is essential to understanding these issues. So then came the Lyndon Johnson. Well, if it wasn't the mafia, we need an alternate sponsor. How about Lyndon Johnson? And after all, cui bono, who he profited from the event. He was power hungry. All his life he wanted to be president of the United States. Wouldn't he be a great sponsor? And so if you look at all these books, of which I mentioned the Roger Stone, Maura McClellan, Men on the Sixth Floor, if you look at all these books, one thing that they have in common, in addition to blaming Lyndon Johnson, is that they never mention any involvement or foreknowledge or cover-up by CIA. CIA is not mentioned in these books. Look at the Roger Stone. And so it's obvious, isn't it, that these people must be CIA assets. If they're not, they're saving the CIA money. They used to say communists. They used to say if you're not a member, then they're dues cheaters, because they might as well be members of the Communist Party for what they're saying, and they're not paying their dues. So here, I think we have every one of these books have that in common. That and one of them on one a video by a Frenchman named William Raymond, it says the assassination of President Kennedy was an example of Texas justice. And nobody, Texas Mafia, and nobody but Texas, the Texans and Texas, was involved in the Kennedy assassination. There's your alternate sponsor. And that's the one that we have at this moment. So that brings us up to date. Now, I want to add one other point, because I'm writing a book about Lyndon Johnson and Mack Wallace. Well, who's Mack Wallace? Mack Wallace was a young man who, among other young men recruited by Lyndon Johnson, and there were many, one of them was Governor Connally. Another one was called Horace Busby. And Johnson gathered, usually they were presidents of the University of Texas. And Mack Wallace had been a student at the University of Texas, was president of the student body in 1944. And after he fell on hard times, Lyndon Johnson scooped him up and took him to Washington, and he came under the umbrella of Lyndon Johnson. Now, Mack Wallace did commit a murder for which he was tried and convicted, and that was the murder of somebody that was having a love affair with both Mack Wallace's wife, and simultaneously,
Douglas Kinzer, I believe.
It was named John Douglas Kinzer, and he was having an affair not only with Mack Wallace's wife, whose name was Andre, but with Johnson's sister, Josepha. So here goes Mack Wallace. I think it's he later himself told people it was a crime of passion. He goes in and he shoots John Douglas Kinzer at his golf course. Kinzer was trying to set up a golf course, 9 holes, and shoots him in cold blood right there in broad daylight with witnesses around. And I won't go through the whole thing, but he was tried and he was convicted. of murder with malice, that what we call first-degree murder. And then, through various reasons, not necessarily related to Lyndon Johnson, I have to say, but jury tampering, he was given a suspended sentence and didn't serve a day in jail. And so he was a murderer. So wouldn't he be just the one to blame for a whole bunch of murders connected with Billy Saul Estes and his crimes and felonies and scams? And all these murders were blamed on Mack Wallace. We have only the word for this of Billy Saul Estes. Now, that may not be enough to say that why Johnson was the mastermind of the Kennedy assassination, but then we need another detail to this, and that is there was one fingerprint up there on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, from which probably no one fired any shots, but there was a fingerprint that the Warren Commission had among its exhibits that was unidentified. They identified all the fingerprints up there, including police, but one was they could not identify, and it sits in the Warren exhibits. And so various researchers, not necessarily with bad will, decided, tested, concluded that this was Mack Wallace's fingerprint. Well, if Mack Wallace's fingerprint was up there, and he was associated with Lyndon Johnson, as indeed he was, then surely this proves, by this contorted reasoning, that Lyndon Johnson must have planned the Kennedy assassination. Take away the fingerprint, and you have nothing really connecting Lyndon Johnson with the mechanics of the Kennedy assassination.
And that was the linchpin that I was mentioning before, because the thing is that it is, you know, a contentious possibility that Johnson had exerted some influence, possibly, when it came to the Kinzer trial. And certainly Mack Wallace was involved with Lyndon Johnson, and Lyndon Johnson was involved, by the way, it's not to say that Lyndon Johnson was an innocent or a clean, individual when it came to, there's been various accusations, some of them founded, some of them not well-founded, about all kinds of things that Johnson did. Even publicly at that time, there were scandals about Johnson when he was vice president, being involved in various underhanded dealings and bribery-type scandals and things like this. And it's a possibility. This is why it was very easy when you put that supposed fingerprint along with the fact that this guy was obviously, like, to put it another way, it's almost like he's a Johnson stooge, that, you know, at least that's the way he was represented. And if you imagine that he was involved in all these criminal activities, he was a murderer, as you just laid out, clearly was a murderer, in fact, of Kinzer, then it was so much easier to take that, tie it all together. But there is a problem here, isn't there, John?
The problem is that it wasn't his print. And it wasn't. And I did I hired people and did the we did the most modern scientific analysis of the print, and it wasn't him.
Right.
Now you could do it. They can swing from the rafters. It just wasn't his print. Now you're going to have to make. Now, as far as Johnson's crimes, I'm really looking into Johnson's career. One of the most telling aspects of Johnson, and of course it's not. It's kept out of the biographies. Robert A. Caro, Robert Dalek, these people do not, they leave Billy Saul Estes out, and they leave Madeline Brown out, who's a liar herself anyway, and they leave out a lot of the, they can't leave out everything. For example, they certainly couldn't leave out the fact that Johnson had no business being in the United States Senate because he subverted the election. And that was called Box 13. And I found new information about Box 13, but it certainly is mentioned in Robert Caro's book. The Billy Saul Estes crimes that Johnson was involved in, profiting from the scams of Billy Saul Estes. You know, when people looked in, Johnson could keep his name out of everything. He could get involved in all sorts of criminal activity, and his name would not appear. You could not pin any of it on him. People had a hard time. Everybody's looking. And I could understand, but nonetheless, it seems pretty apparent that what Johnson did was to sell public office for personal profit. And so all the contracts that that went to Texas, he got a cut out of everything. The Brown and Root that he started out helping them in the late 1930s, the minute he got into the House of Representatives. And in the second phase of the Marshall Ford Dam, not the first, but the second phase, they would. This is what made Brown and Root. They were nothing before that. And to top it off, Brown and Root, through Johnson's efforts, Johnson got on the Naval Service Committee, Naval Affairs Committee, the minute he got to the House with the help of Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, who Johnson managed to convince. Was that Johnson presented himself as a New Dealer, and so Roosevelt liked it. And the fact is, Johnson believed in nothing, had no principles, had no morality, was a liar, but he managed to, I don't know, that flattery, tremendous amount of flattery, and what some people call the Texas charm. I don't find the Texas charm very charming. I find it chilling. But some find it charming, and they like the flattery and whatever. And so Johnson got on the Naval Affairs Committee, and the first thing that he did there was to make sure that the Corpus Christi Naval Station, which was just this is at the turn of World War II, was awarded to primarily, not totally, but primarily to Brown and Root. They had never built a military. Now, after that, they built many, many military bases, but not that was. They never had built a naval base. They never had built a ship. They suddenly became shipbuilders. After World War II, they bought from the government the pipelines that the government no longer needed, gas pipelines, Big Inch and Little Inch, and that became Texas Eastern, one of the biggest subsidiaries of Brown and Root, and so forth. Now, we cannot prove that Johnson was given a cut. We certainly can prove that illegal campaign contributions came to Johnson from Brown and Root because they were brought before the Internal Revenue Service for it, and Roosevelt had got them off with a very small fine, and that was in the 1941 election. Johnson had run for the United States Senate in 1941 and lost, but got a huge amount of contributions from Brown and Root, and of course again in 1948 he did. So this is a mutual admiration society. And when Johnson, by the time, let's say, 1964 comes, the net worth of Lyndon Johnson was $24 million. Now, when you think, and he did many scams, many, many, but when you think that President Kennedy was considered a rich man, only had $10 million, you can see what enormous efforts that Lyndon Johnson made to feathering his nest. And he was a master actor, tremendously shrewd. And he had people like Bobby Baker, and he had people like Billy Solestes and others to help him along. And, of course, in those days, in Texas, as in Louisiana, you could give campaign contributions anytime. You know, the person didn't have to be running for office.
Right.
Which is incredible. So then you could call any kind of gift that you wanted to give a campaign contribution. All sorts of methods that they had. Johnson and the radio station and the control of that, and how Johnson retained a monopoly on the radio station. He had the only radio station and TV station in Austin, Texas.
In his wife's name.
Ridiculous. And then he would sell, people were forced to buy advertising on these radio and the TV station, and if they didn't, they suffered the consequences, and he got money that way. There were so many scams and so many ways.
Yeah, there's always an array of ways that any criminal enterprise, no matter what you're looking at, there's always got to be an array of options for laundering the money, and Johnson certainly had many, many options for doing that. But again, to put him as a mastermind for something as extreme as the assassination of John F. Kennedy, there is just no foundation for it. If there was, that would be one thing. There's plenty of foundation for all these criminal acts that we're talking about, and we don't even have, we could probably sit and do this show for the next 3 months for 2 hours every week and not even complete all of the stuff that Johnson had his fingers in. And Brown and Root, by the way, just for those who are saying to themselves, you know, this stuff isn't really relevant nowadays, or it isn't relevant to any of the current events, I always try and point out, you know, this is where a lot of things were seeded. Brown and Root, later on, you can link it to things like, ready for this, Halliburton. Okay?
Well, Halliburton bought Brown and Root the minute that Herman Brown died in December of 1962. And they didn't want to sell. So George Brown, the surviving brother, signed the papers for the sale to Halliburton just then. And so then George stayed on. I don't know the exact financial arrangements. He was still involved with Brown and Root at the time that they fortified themselves in Vietnam. I want to say something else about Brown and Root that is interesting, and it's in my update also for the Farewell to Justice. And that is that Jim Garrison was very angry at Lyndon Johnson for not releasing the files and exhibits of the Warren Commission. And looking at Lyndon Johnson, he also saw, as people later pretend, like Caro pretends that he made the discovery that Johnson was supported by Herman and George Brown. But, of course, everyone knew it before that. It was no new discovery. Garrison looked at Johnson, and he saw the Browns. And Herman was dead already when Garrison made his investigation. There was George Brown. So the name of George Brown came up in the Garrison investigation. And some of the spies that, Chuck, that you referred to earlier, such as William Gurbich, who was a cheap detective who plied the port of New Orleans down there, real low figure. Anyway, he infiltrated. Garrison was very trusting. That was one of Garrison's faults. He had faults. This was no saint. And one of them was he let people in who would flatter him and who would seem to be committed, and they were really spying and cheating and stealing documents and so forth. And so Gurbich is listening to what's going on in the office, and he hears the name George Brown. And so he reported it to a media asset, CIA media asset, named Hugh Ainsworth. Now, Hugh Ainsworth then called up George Brown and told him his name was mentioned. Garrison was accusing him, which wasn't the case at all, of being involved in the Kennedy assassination. And as a result of that whole little dance, if you like, Garrison liked to use that metaphor of the dance, as a result of all that, guess what? The CIA looks at George Brown, and they know him well. And so we get the most valuable document that I think we have on the whole Kennedy assassination, in my humble opinion, and that is a description of the CIA service, the service to the clandestine services of Herman and George Brown, and a whole list of executives of Brown and Root. And they were all part of CIA starting in the early 1950s. Whoa. And as a result also, we get a look in the same document at various foundations, including the Brown Foundation, which was a foundation set up by George Brown, I think, and all of them. And they were used as pass-throughs. CIA used these foundations as pass-throughs to fund domestic activities or things that they were not entitled to, according to their charter, the use of the foundations. And all this came out in Congress by a Texas congressman named Wright Patton, who exposed it all. And so there we have the CIA's own document admitting to the use of Herman and George Brown, which is gold in terms of how we connect all these things. As Don DeLillo says in his great novel Underworld, everything is connected. And here we have it. And it was not for Garrison. And I think, Chuck, you were saying earlier, if not for Garrison, Oliver Stone wouldn't have had the film, and if not for the film, we wouldn't have had the John F. Kennedy Assassination Records and Collection Act, and we wouldn't have had all the documents and none of these books that have been written about the Kennedy assassination in the last 20 years would never have been published.
And the Assassination Records Review Board, which was formed as a result from the outcry of that movie, and again, I say, you could trace that back to Garrison's case, the fact that Stone had publicized it, and all of that stuff, which later gave us that marvelous collection that is there now at the National Archives. All of these things give you a blueprint for the anatomy of many of the intelligence services' attempts to subvert many things, especially the media assets. That stuff is laid out so clearly. And Hugh Ainsworth, just in case my listeners think that is a familiar name, Hugh Ainsworth is one of these guys that is always pulled out. He's still being pulled out today on all of these Oswald Did It shows as an assassination witness, as an authority on the real situations that were occurring in Dallas and all these things, because he was a reporter in Dallas at the time. But as you point out, this guy can be tied to the agency. He was definitely an asset. That's just the way it is. And on top of that, when you examine this stuff that's coming out all the time, again, this is how it works. It gives you a blueprint for how it is they turn around and discredit people and stuff like this. Now, another little point that I wanted to make here, and it's just a small point, is that you're not talking about Jim Garrison as somebody that you learned about through the JFK movie or that you happened to read about because he was in assassination literature or anything like that. You actually knew the man, didn't you?
Well, what happened was I mentioned earlier on our program the Paese Sera newspaper series about the CIA front, Permandex and Centro Mondiale Commerciale. Mm-hmm. Well, my husband was living in London at the time, and we weren't married then, but he got a set of those newspapers, and he sent them to Jim Garrison in New Orleans. So in May of 1969, Garrison, Shaw, of course, was acquitted in March. In May of 1969, Garrison invited my husband and me to New Orleans, and he wanted to thank Ralph and like that. So there we go. We go, and I'd never been to New Orleans. It's terribly hot down there, I have to tell you. It was sultry, and I was sick. And so the photograph in A Farewell to Justice, I look pretty bedraggled. I'm sick with fever from the sultry weather, and Garrison is, and my husband and I are sitting in the hotel room, and Garrison is talking about the Kennedy assassination. And the blinds were bothering me. The sun was, so somebody working for the hotel came in to fix the blinds, and he said, "Hello, Mr. Garrison." And I found that surprising. By the way, at the hotel, it was the Hotel Monte Leon on Royal Street, and Garrison registered us as Mr. and Mrs. Lyndon Baines Johnson, which is really very funny in the light of everything that has happened since, even funnier. But when this man said hello, I said, "Well, gee, how come he's saying hello to Mr. Garrison?" I had no idea. And then when we walked in the street, we were going to the Garrison's favorite restaurant, which was called Moran La Louisiane. Mm-hmm. And people in the street, especially black people, are saying hello to Mr. Garrison. And I think, I don't even know. I did not know that he was district attorney, which he was. He had been reelected, in fact. Did he? No. No, no. He was running for re-election because the election was probably that autumn. You would not know that he was district attorney except for people are recognizing him in the street because he's talking all the while about the Kennedy assassination. And I thought that was all he cared about, really, was the Kennedy assassination. Well, I knew Garrison's ambition in life was not to be a district attorney or a lawyer or any of this. He wanted to be an author. And so he was writing manuscripts and books about the Kennedy assassination and novels, and he would send them to me, and he wanted to talk 3 hours at a stretch. And those who know him, like, say, Vince Landry in Philadelphia, people who have been his friend, know that he could talk for hours and hours. You didn't say a word, and he's talking about his writing and what he's thinking and what he's doing. And this went on for some years. And then in the early 1970s, when he was charged by the federal government for taking bribes from pinball operators, illegal pinball gambling interests, and he was on trial and he was framed. It was clear that he was framed, and I thought, well, this would be a great subject for a book. I want to write a book about Garrison and what happened to him, of course, Garrison was acquitted both of taking the bribes, and then he was tried again by the Internal Revenue Service for not paying taxes on the bribes that he was acquitted of taking.
Yeah, most interestingly, he was acquitted of the tax evasion on the bribes that it had already been established in a court of law he hadn't taken. That was the fascinating part of that for me.
Yes. So anyway, I thought I'll write this book then, and then I just didn't. I didn't know how to write a biography. I certainly didn't know enough about any of this. So, you know, I didn't start then Garrison. So I saw him again. The last time I saw Garrison was in 1987. And Oliver Stone was working on his film, and he was very happy about that. He was going to play Chief Justice Earl Warren. Garrison played Earl Warren in the film, which he thought was funny. And but he was just the same in 1987 as he had been in 1969, talking nonstop about the fact that the brother of Dulles' second-in-command, General Charles Cabell, was the mayor of Dallas at the time of the Kennedy assassination, and the business with the parade route was a change. Going over this material, that Oswald never fired a shot, going over this over and over again. And then he got sick, and I didn't start writing and doing the research, the actual book, until 1997. I wrote many, many books since. during that time. But I didn't start again until 1997. And the first person, two people together, they were afraid to see me alone. I saw the two people that I saw first were Frank Mignard, who was the coroner of Orleans Parish for many, many years. He was the only white man that got reelected in later years. But Frank told me that when he would go into the house of somebody to collect a dead body, he's the coroner, he would see three photographs in the black people's homes. There was, predictably, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., right. There was John F. Kennedy, and there was Jim Garrison. These are the people that were most admired. And so Frank told me that, and Lou Ivan was the other person that was with him. And they began to tell me about Jim Garrison, what he was like and his life. And it was funny. I think one of the things that I missed in the Oliver Stone film that was the humor of Garrison, that sardonic irony. And it's, I love the line, my favorite line, it still is, the line of Garrison where he says, he's talking about in his investigation and being in the investigation, and he said, I thought I was living in the country I was born in. And the country that he was born in was a country with civil liberties, with justice under the law, and you don't have a country, for example, in which when he charged Clay Shaw with perjury after the Shaw trial, it went into federal court, which it had no business. It was a state of Louisiana matter, perjury. It's not a federal crime. But somehow it got into federal court, and it was dismissed because Shaw lied on the stand in the trial, and he said that he didn't know Oswald and he didn't know David Ferry. And we have like 10 witnesses or more. There were some that didn't appear at the trial, black and white, who said that they saw Shaw, and this is very important, Shaw and Ferry and Oswald driving in a black Cadillac up to Jackson and Clinton, Louisiana, north of Baton Rouge. And Oswald had gone up there to register to vote. And we had to try to figure out what Garrison had. All the witnesses said he saw that that Oswald did register to vote, and his name was in the book of the registrar of voters, Henry Earl Palmer, and then it was erased. And then the book disappeared entirely the next day. And what happened there, which I try to interview every single Clinton witness who was still alive. I did quite a few. And what happened there was that the assignment that Clay Shaw, who was a very fancy person, a socialite, the director of the International Trademark, person who hung out with at Mardi Gras with all kinds of celebrities, whatever, although Garrison said, somebody asked Garrison, do you think that Shaw could ever have been Rex? Rex is the king of Mardi Gras. And Garrison said he would sooner be the king of England, because, of course, Shaw was not exactly reputable. And not only that, but he might have been part African-American, which is not so good. So in any case, they drove up there. And the assignment, so Shaw would never have been in the company of Oswald had he not been on assignment from CIA. And they drive up there. The assignment was that Oswald get a job at the insane asylum, which is really what it was, the East Louisiana State Hospital at Jackson. And you know, he went up there and he filled out the application, best we can figure out. And then and I got the applications myself. I have copies. And it says, are you a registered voter in East Louisiana Parish? Which is where the hospital was located. It was in Jackson.
Right.
And on the other side of the hospital is a town called Slaughter, Slaughter, if you can believe that. And there's a marvelous book, this is a digression a little bit, called Coming Through Slaughter by the great writer Michael Ondaatje, who wrote The English Patient. And it was about a musician called Buddy Bolden, who was incarcerated in the early days in the East Louisiana State Hospital. All right, so Oswald sees, are you a registered voter? And so he goes back to Clinton and gets online to register to vote. And as we all know, many know, that just on that day, there was a voter registration drive sponsored by the Congress of Racial Equality Corps, and everybody's in the street, blacks and whites who don't speak to each other, of course. This is deep segregation. So the idea, as Shaw's lawyers try to say, that this was a conspiracy in which the whites and the blacks conspired to make up a story about Oswald being up there is fatuous, because as one of the black witnesses said to me, Verla Bell, she said, if a person was white, we'd cross the street. You don't talk to them. So there was never any possibility of it. But they'd say anything. They were desperate, you see. The Shaw's defense was desperate because Garrison was right about everything, really. And I think all I want to say that updating my book 8 years after the book was originally published, every document that I found supports Garrison's findings. Everything that he said that Shaw was involved in a conspiracy, we have that document that he was a paid contract source. I want to repeat that. Highly paid. And this is amazing. And I gave out that document. In fact, I printed that document in a little book that I wrote about George de Morenschild. George de Morenschild was Oswald's handler in Dallas and Fort Worth. And even though it didn't, like, what is this document about Clay Shaw doing in there? I wanted to make it public as soon as possible. That book is called Our Man in Haiti. And it has a set of documents at the back, some of them from military intelligence, some of them from CIA, because you want to show the documents and show people exactly what the sources are. It's extremely difficult to, if you have the documents, God bless Oliver Stone. God bless the people who, Bill Clinton, although I despise his politics and his wife's politics, but my goodness, if they signed, they met in palmier days, shall we say, even at the days of Barack Obama and the drones. In those days, that they would let a John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Collection Act get published and 5 million documents get released to the National Archives, and we can write these books and we can see sometimes traces of the truth, sometimes actual truths. And if you just sit and we have to wonder, even I've said this years ago, where are the mainstream media? Where are researchers like Robert A. Caro and others who are never to be seen in the archives in Maryland looking at these documents and trying to figure out what the assassination was about, which is why we get in Caro's latest volume the standard Warren Commission lie that there were only 3 shots in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd. It's shocking, actually, quite shocking. And but I think that if you want the Pulitzer Prize, if you want the National Book Award, you have to write that. You have to write that there were only 3 shots. And it's a pity that the truth is not the motive of these authors. Very sad. And Johnson has really gotten cover from these biographers because they presented him as credible. Sure, he had faults. Sure. So forth, but then they trot out the Civil Rights Act and the Voter Rights Act and the so-called Great Society, right. And they use that as a way of saying they're going to give a balanced view. And I think this is not the place to discuss all that and evaluate all that, but we ought to throw some light on it anyway. I think one of the things I've discovered in looking into Lyndon Johnson. And if the audience want to contact me and help me on this, I'd really appreciate it. And that is Johnson's role in the cover-up of the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty. June 8th, 1967. Mm. Because, of course, it was part of the 1967 war of Israeli aggression against Egypt, Jordan, Syria. If I left out a country, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that is, again, this is my point about, and the USS Liberty is a topic of discussion among people that care about the truth and the reality of the way that the, we refer to it often as the military-industrial complex, but the way that these things function to this day is laid out in these weapons of mass distraction that they utilize in these media cover stories, in these programmed assets coming at us with all of these different storylines and just really all sort of misleading misdirection. And it's amazing sometimes when you begin to study things for yourself, what the difference is between that nonsense and the reality. And one of the biggest crimes that that Johnson ever gave to us as a people was the Vietnam War. That a lot of people in recent years, I'm still arguing with people, and I don't know why this is, they are attributing it to Kennedy as if it was Kennedy's war. And it's my solid belief that if he had not been killed that day in Dallas, we would not have had the black eye that this society took with that war. Now, that's
something about that. Again, I want to pull the camera back a little bit and look at possible different approaches to history. And I thought years ago that this view of the great man view of history had been discredited and had been seen as rather primitive way of looking at things. And that view says this individual is evil, this individual is good, this one caused, without looking at the social forces and the dynamic in the society that really is at play, how the system was working. No individual makes these wars. And when I was young, as I look in the picture with Jim Garrison, I believed, and I protested, boy, I was protesting against Johnson, and in Des Moines, Iowa, one day, and with the maybe 10 people, and he was going into a public building with Lady Bird and the two birds, the daughters, black hair shining like a raven's wing. Mm. And we were yelling, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" And they were sneaking in the side door because Johnson could not appear in public anymore. When was this? 1965 or 6? Maybe it was 66. Johnson could not appear in public because without getting, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids?" But was Johnson really the architect of the Vietnam War? No, I don't believe it. I believe that the war was what we're calling the military-industrial complex, the intelligence agencies. I mean, after all, CIA murdered 50,000 people in Vietnam, throwing them out of helicopters and whatnot, apart from the general murders of Vietnamese and on the ground. So whose war was this? This is the war. This is the war of late capitalism trying to fortify itself, trying to put its foot everywhere, make sure that the world, and that means the entire planet, even faraway Vietnam, is open to the American business, and particularly the defense contractors. And Johnson is not directly then the architect. In fact, you know the famous quote in Stanley Carnow's History of the Vietnam War, to one of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I guess this must have been in 1964, "You get me elected and I'll give you your war."
Mm.
Not my war, your war, and that's correct. It was the military's war, it was CIA's war, and it was, of course, capitalism, defense contractors, people that profited from the war. It wasn't Lyndon Johnson's war, nor would it have been. And so the idea that John F. Kennedy could have stopped it, well, I'm going to have to hesitate. Maybe if he could have stopped it, he would only temporarily have stopped it. They were going to do it. Because look what we have now. We had many wars since then. We have Iraq. We have Afghanistan. We have many bases now in so many countries where wars are being facilitated, ready, drones, whatnot, and all because, to keep the system afloat. Well, and no individual. I mean, Barack Obama's their clone. He's their puppet. The same way I think Johnson is no different from Johnson, no different from George W. Worse than George W. Bush, because he's done more murders with these flying robots than George W. Bush by far. So what does it mean? And I devote a long section in my book about Cuba, actually. I wrote a book about Cuba at CIA because Garrison made me interested in CIA, sent me onto the path of CIA. So I wrote this book because it had nothing to do with the Kennedy assassination per se, except that it's the perpetrator, CIA, is in this. And it's called The Great Game in Cuba. Mm-hmm. And in that book, I take time out and I look at whether there's any difference between the Democratic and the Republican parties. And what I found, I mean, a marvelous quote from the chief legal officer of CIA, who'd been the head lawyer for, since day one, named Lawrence Houston. And Lawrence Houston confesses, I think it's to the Church Committee, he testifies, and he says, "Listen, we," meaning CIA, "we put people in both the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee, and we always have."
They sure do.
All the same. And when we look at the voting, part of that book is involved with the head of King Ranch, Robert J. Clayburgh Jr. is a great American figure, I have to say, and he had a ranch in Cuba, and that's how he gets into the book. But Clayburgh voted, of course, in the old days when they were young. He was born in the late 19th century. Everyone in Texas was a so-called Democrat. But once that passed, and they never liked Roosevelt, so once that passed, his brother, who was a congressman, ran on the Democratic ticket. But once that passed, he would vote mostly for Republicans, sometimes for a Democrat. He hated Lyndon Johnson for reasons that I discuss in the book, and I'll discuss again in my book about Mack Wallace. And and the same thing George Brown says, Republican or Democrat, it makes no difference. We're interested in the oil. The oil is out there, and he's very frank, George Brown. What does he care? He was so powerful. These people are part of the U.S. military. and the Navy helps them. Who were the partners of Brown and Root in Vietnam? Whether they were under the umbrella of Halliburton or anyone else, it was the U.S. Navy helping them, fortifying them, giving them money. They were part of the U.S. military, really, since the Corpus Christi Naval Station at the turn of the 1940s.
See, to put it in a simple way, I just believe that the fact that Kennedy was beginning to withdraw us from Vietnam was part of the why that he was killed for.
Well, and you have to look at Richard Reeves' biography, and it's called President Kennedy. And somebody asked me yesterday, well, how come the Sixth Floor Museum is hosting Richard Reeves? Mm. And I said, Richard Reeves has written the best biography of President Kennedy. And the reason that they killed him was that he was opposed to them. That was very – he had a tremendous fight with CIA. First of all, they were making policy on their own. And he said – this is a direct quote. I'll get those CIA bastards if it's the last thing I do. Mm. So they were mad. He was going to take away money from them, which they've had unlimited money then and up to this day. And he was going to limit the powers of the director of director of Central Intelligence. And he was doing things. He took away the U-2s. He wanted to take away even the little radio station that they had in the Caribbean called Radio Swan. He went down there. He sent Richard Goodwin down there. And Goodwin goes to Jerry Hemming and Howard K. Davis and asks, you know, CIA. It was a CIA station run by David Atlee Phillips. And they say, no, we're not. They just say no to President Kennedy because they knew, these soldiers of fortune knew, CIA was more powerful than John F. Kennedy.
Well, it was a recurring theme. The intelligence agencies, that's exactly who he was at war with, was the entire intelligence complex.
But he didn't stand a chance. And he was never going to be able to get out of Vietnam. They had their hearts set on Vietnam, and that was it. And one way or another, they were going to go into Vietnam. The idea that he could stop that? Well, I think I don't want to go into the realms of speculation. What would have done, could have done, what he should have done. We only know that the CIA was not going to let that happen.
See, I'm just pointing to
they didn't let it happen. And whether he was going to get to take back 1,000 people, who knows? I'm not a Kennedy. You know, I have criticisms of Robert Kennedy particularly. And I don't always distrust CIA. I think that's wrong. And in the discussion of Operation Mongoose, where Bobby Kennedy was up to his eyeballs in the plots to murder Fidel Castro, for example, I'm going to rely, and I don't care what anyone says about this, on a very honest CIA officer named Sam Halpern. Because Sam Halpern was very much involved with Mongoose under William Harvey, watching Bobby Kennedy. And Sam Halpern he said, you're blaming us? Because, you know, they were a touchy CIA, and they were not to blame for these plots, those particular set of plots under Mongoose. And he noted, he's sitting outside the office of the, first of all, Bobby Kennedy asked Sam Halpern to give him a CIA officer to work for him on these plots to kill Castro. His name was called Charlie Ford, alias Fiscalini. Fiscalini. So what is Fiscalini asked to do by Bobby Kennedy? To go find mafia people in hitmen in Canada to go kill Fidel Castro. Now, this hypocrisy of this, because you know Bobby Kennedy, the great opponent of the mafia and all that, here he is wanting to adequately look for mafia hitmen to kill Castro. Whoa. And I think to lie about this, to attack Sam Halpern, who's telling the truth, and you please look at the internal interview within CIA, which is available at the National Archives, of Sam Halpern talking to two CIA people, and so this might be, it's informal, and it's clear that he's not lying. There's no chance that he's lying, and he's telling exactly what he saw. And I think that there are no sacred cows. That's what Garrison said, when he was criticizing the judges. The sacred cows, they think they can do anything that they want. And we're talking about a political system. And everybody who's in elected office is part of that system. We're not talking about Eugene Debs here. We're not talking about people who are willing to make the sacrifices necessary to stand up for justice. These are few and far between.
Oh, yes.
I can't think of that many examples. Debs is certainly one. But I'm not prepared with all the names of the people. There are very few. You can find some of them. I think it's a well-known book, which is very weak on the Kennedy assassination, and that's Howard Zinn's book, The People's History of the United States. weak. I mean, it doesn't even mention the Kennedy assassination. And I think I know why. Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky, the late Alexander Coburn, why don't they want to talk about the Kennedy assassination? People often ask that. And I think the reason is that they can't quite see the internal warfare of President Kennedy with CIA. So they see Kennedy, and they can see him this way, as another capitalist politician. Too bad he was killed, but no great loss, see. And in a way, they're right, because it's the system we're dealing with. Look at what we've got now. If the system weren't going in this direction, why would we have all these wars that we have now? We shouldn't be at war. And actually fighting to keep troops in Afghanistan. And, of course, as the New York Times pointed out a week or so ago, the reason that the United States wants to keep so many people in Afghanistan, supposedly winding down, is that we need them to protect the drone base there.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And this drone thing is really, that's something new technologically in the last decades, maybe in the millennium. That's the gift of the millennium. Horrifying. I want to recommend Robert Greenwald's film on the drones, which is available on the internet, I believe, free. Robert Greenwald.
Right.
Well, and you'll be amazed to see the details of how many casualties, what they call, of civilians and children and elders and people that were killed by drones in Pakistan.
Well, right, and I'm not, stating that Kennedy was in control. As a matter of fact, when I wrote an article years ago, one of my statements that people really went after me for was, I said that JFK had made the mistake of believing that he was in charge of so many things that were really under the purview of the CIA or other intelligence agencies that were really, truly in control of the war machine at the time.
And that's my quote. I have to give this quote from Gerald Patrick Hemming. I always give it on every speech. And that is, Jerry said, sardonically, John F. Kennedy, which is what you're saying, Chuck, John F. Kennedy was the last president who thought he could take power, but thought he could take power. Partly that was because he was a, rich young man, a person with prerogatives, who had everything his own way in life and so forth. But he found out otherwise. Every president since then has better watched himself, because the example was, if you don't, you come up against us, and you're likely to lose your life.
You challenge us, and you are liable to be gunned down in broad daylight on the streets of the country that you are supposed to be in charge of. That is, I think, the lesson that was passed along, and I think it's been learned. And I think that's why these guys fold up, and that's why they really, when it comes down to these kind of things, like the horror that people seem to still underestimate about these drones, is just really, we can see the evolution of where we are, how it came to be, if you begin to study this stuff. And this is why, and this is why I never allow anybody to tell me that that's not relevant anymore. It is quite relevant. It gives you the diagram. It gives you the trajectory for where we were to end up half a century later. You knew it was coming because of what went on here. Obviously, the seeds of all this were planted long before. We could discuss how the CIA came to be and what the actual operational responsibilities were, and the OSS and Operation Paperclip and the influences of all those things. But the reality is, if you give an honest look at the true history that occurred, you can see how this evolved. And it's no surprise. It's not as though this stuff is in place now, from taken out of, whole cloth from thin air. This stuff grew and festered like a disease. And the idea that Kennedy was probably the last guy to challenge that. I always say, and I know it's kind of flippant and a little bit too broad of a statement, but I always say that I believe that JFK was the last true president we had. Now, that's not to say.
Well, he didn't accomplish enough, Chuck.
Well, he didn't have the time.
But he didn't. Whether he had time or not time or whatever, the fact is that there isn't a body of law or a body of efforts, or he had trouble keeping his head above water there. And I have to say, again, I remember John F. Kennedy's campaign for president. He promised that he would, in those days, this is extremely important, maybe it's not so understood now, he promised that he would desegregate federally sponsored housing. That is, if the federal government built housing, you couldn't have, you had to have black and white living together, and not only making it available to whites. That was a big, big campaign promise of 1960. And he didn't do it. He didn't do it. He didn't do it. He didn't do it. And then years later, I was at a dinner. Who's across the table from me? Ted Sorensen. And I say just what I said to you, federal housing and everything. And then he doesn't say anything. And then that's sort of the end of the dinner. I go into the next room with a coffee. I'm upset at this. This is very upsetting. So I go in and have the coffee. Sorensen rushes out of the room to follow me into the living room with the where the coffee was and says he was going to. Now, okay, but maybe. But that was not good enough. And we also have for another example. I don't want to, you know, because we have to have a balanced view. This is not some kind of saint. When he was terrified of the Red Scare, even in 63, he was afraid of red baiting and communist, you know, the Cold War. And so he had took Martin Luther King, and this is very well known, depicted in Taylor Branch's book, Parting the Waters, which is a biography of Martin Luther King, Jr. And he demanded of Martin Luther, you know, outside in the Rose Garden, no one could hear it, not on tape. He said that Martin Luther King had to fire two people from his staff because they were communists. Now, nobody was a communist anymore in 1963. I mean, and by now we are not, believe enough in civil liberties that we're allowed to be communists or anything else. But there was one called Stanley Levinson and one, I think, Floyd O'Dell, if I have that correct, too. And Martin Luther King had no choice. He didn't. And I should also add that during the March on Washington in August of 1963, John F. Kennedy, everybody expected President Kennedy to sort of say hello or wave or something. Instead, the federal government insisted that every one of those marches be out of town by sundown. Out. They were not, they were totally peaceful. This is A. Philip Randolph. This is Bayard Rustin. This is, these are not, and then, of course, the speeches were censored. So and that's particularly, asked John Lewis about that. He's still around.
Right.
And, very fiery young man in those days and a person working with Dr. King. So the idea that I've heard that, oh, you know, he was President Kennedy was really a great radical, let's say liberal. No, he wasn't. He really wasn't. He was trying. And I think he perceived toward the end there that CIA was taking over. That's what I think he perceived, and he tried to fight against it. CIA did things, for example, the missiles in Cuba that CIA knew very well were there and were telling Senator Kenneth Keating of New York, who went on the floor of the Senate and said all these things, and Kennedy said, how did he get all that information? CIA did not brief him. And there were many signs of things like that, and he was at war with CIA. That was, I think, his big war, the war that he could never admit to in public, where he never said anything.
Right.
And I'm upset in a way I never, you know, I'll never forget. You know, it seems to me that Robert Kennedy owed it to his brother to speak out, whether or not Robert Kennedy's efforts with Mongoose and his knowledge of Oswald and all that, whether or not that would have emerged, so what? It would have been much more important for the country if Bobby Kennedy, and also saved his own life in addition, if he had spoken out about what he knew. Because certainly they knew, and I found, I mentioned it's in the Farewell to Justice, I sent someone to talk to Arthur Schlesinger, because he wouldn't talk to me, I don't think, at that time. So I said to Wilmer Thomas, who was a classmate of Garrison's from the Tulane School of Law, ask Arthur Schlesinger. He used to go to lunch every day at the Century Association, of which I was a member, Wilmer was a member. Schlesinger went there every day for lunch. So I said, go ask him who he thinks killed President Kennedy. And Wilmer went and did it. He wanted to know, too. And Schlesinger said, and I think this is really honest, very honest. He never said this in public. We were at war with the national security people. That's the real truth of the Kennedy administration, of the Kennedy presidency. We were at war with the national security people. A valiant effort, I'll have to say, but no chance of winning.
Oh, yeah, and I understand, and believe me, I'm not one of these guys, and I know there are people out there like this who try to elevate Kennedy to a level of radical, you know, really down-to-earth, completely for the people president. That's not what the truth is, okay? When you create the entire portrait of the man, he wasn't this, you know, perfect, angelic, you know, figure in American history, but the reason why I bring these things up and the reason why I do point to them is because so often I see that there is a great effort made to smear him in a way with a brush of, you know, this guy wasn't that important. It's not that big of a deal that he died. These people waste their time looking into it because, after all, he was just a playboy and he was just a rich boy playing at being president. And he was more interested in women than he was anything else, and all these other things with the, you know, with the distortions about his medical situations, with the distortions about his relationships with his family. Some things are true, but the idea that he was just another one of these elites that did nothing but, you know, satisfy his own urges, and that's really what he was, and he was just, you know, a guy who had been portrayed as someone who was valuable to the American people when he wasn't, that's not true either.
Well, Chuck, the thing is that where do you get social change? You don't get it from a Kennedy. You don't get it from a Lyndon Johnson. You don't get it from a God knows who. You get it from large numbers of people speaking out and demanding it, such as the women's movement in the 1970s, the women out in the streets nonstop. And making great personal sacrifices. Then you get Roe v. Wade. You get some the freedom of women over their own bodies. Where do you get the civil rights movement? You get it from blood, and you get it from somebody like Bob Moses. You don't get it from Lyndon Johnson.
No.
None of these individuals make change. Change comes from a widespread feeling among a large number of people that want feel that they're not gaining justice.
And the leaders among those large.
Kennedy, whether the Kennedy didn't, as I said about the desegregation, of one pen, one signature could have done that. It was so overdue, really. And
I agree there, but, you know, and the truth that I want to underline here is that among those groups of dissatisfied people that speak up, quite often it is the agitators who lead it. It is the people that are disagreeable and refuse to accept the unjust situations that really do cause the change to occur. You don't look for Barack Obama to set you free at this time. You know, this has been the twist in my brain with a lot of people where I don't understand, you know, they're disappointed that you know, oh, well, we voted for him and we thought they were going to do this and we thought they were going to do that. This is not how that discourse is going to come to fruition ever. Okay, and it doesn't matter if it was JFK, if it was LBJ, or if it was W or whoever, you're not going to get it from that guy.
Well, but you know, we had certain satisfaction in 1968. We did, when Lyndon Johnson had a slink away and he was planning to run. Partly the story, which we won't go into today, but part of the USS Liberty story has to do with Johnson having his eye on being reelected in 1968 and realizing that he's going to want the Jewish vote and he'll do anything to get it. So I really, at least I felt it at the time when I was a very young person and not so knowledgeable maybe, but that people out in the streets, hundreds of thousands of people, demanding that we get out of Vietnam. Certainly, that demand was not met. The war lasted a decade, and they didn't get out right away. They didn't get out until 1974, I think. So it wasn't. But they did. But the Johnson had to go. So he was a sacrifice to the movement. But they still needed to stay in Vietnam because these wars are about duration. That's what winning is. Winning is how long you can stay and how much money you can make out of staying. And so they stay, and that's what we had in Iraq and so forth, Afghanistan too.
Exactly. This is why we have these wars where there are no clear objectives. The purpose of the war is not to win at this point. It's just to perpetuate the machine, to feed the machine. And by machine, I do mean the conglomeration of all of the interests that benefit from war. And that is the key. That has never ceased to be. Ever since this entity, you know, crawled up into our country, or the country that, again, I believed I was born into and have since learned is not. And Garrison made that point, and it always stuck with me, that, you know, I really do hope that eventually we can return to the nation that we were promised. We can return to that type of society where hope and change are not buzzwords, and there is a real evolution of actual, you know, progress and the ability for people to be people without these kind of things hanging over their heads. And, you know, we're getting close to the time when I'm going to end this, but we got a little bit of time left.
Is there any issues that we haven't, that you wanted to raise that we haven't raised yet?
Well, I've been so fascinated with just about every single aspect of all this. It's like, it's amazing. I get ready to say something practically, Joan, and you're already going to it. So I'm like, you know, I don't know if anybody can hear me, but I start to go and I stop because you're going there anyway. You know, it is so relevant. And for the people, again, I can't stress this enough, for the people that say that, you know, that this is a historical event and does it really matter? Believe me, this is not the history. This is more like the current events than you think. And as you pointed out,
one of the things that we need to do, mm-hmm. I'll add this, is to really look very closely at the structure of CIA. We don't know about it. For example, I only found out recently that in every city where there was a CIA field office, there was also a separate office of CIA's Office of Security. And this was as large an entity as the clandestine services. So this is, and there's a Byzantine structure which is constantly changing, and the names are changing, and the different components and directorates and so forth. And we have to really look. But if the documents, many of the documents, somehow are finding their way, they're not filed with the finding aids. It's very hard to get your hands on them, but they're there. And if we look at them, we can really see. What is this organization? How is it structured? Who knows what? How are decisions made? And how big is it, for example? And we can get a better understanding of there was once a book called Who Rules America by a sociologist, I think, called William Domhoff. Mm-hmm. And we need really to answer that question. And that's what Jim Garrison set us on the path to do. He really didn't know that much about CIA. He relied on a CIA plant, actually, who came into his office called William Wood, whom he named Boxley, to give him some handwritten descriptions of the components of CIA, which we have in the Garrison records. Mm-hmm. But he was trying to figure out who are these guys. It's sort of like that line from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, when they're being followed by the Pinkerton detectives. And who are those guys? And I think Garrison is looking at CIA, and he doesn't know much about it. And who are these people? After all, they're only, let's say they were 20 years in, only, that's how old they were at the time. And we can study history of CIA if we really have the fortitude to do it. And to see what they have been, and start out with George Kennan, the diplomat George Kennan, who had been attached to the United States Embassy in Moscow during World War II, and is famous as an American diplomat. And he was enlisted by Alan Dulles to write a document that's dated 10-2, October 2nd, and to describe the powers that would be granted by the National Security Council to CIA. And they included murder, embezzlement, black operations, assassination, and all manner of things. And CIA has used that 10-2 since 1946 or 7 as a justification for all sorts of nefarious activities that they've committed, both domestically and which they don't admit to, and abroad. And later in his life, when George Tenet was talking to his biographer, he said that 10/2 was the greatest mistake he ever made in his life. And he said it several times.
Mm.
But Dulles made him do it. Dulles, although he didn't actually join CIA as an employee until 1951, was the mastermind with Donovan, but then without Donovan, Dulles by himself and James Forrestal and various cronies of his, they created CIA. And they created the entity that we have today. By the time presidents, well, when did President Truman first figure out who they were? After the Kennedy assassination, when Truman writes that famous editorial on the front page of the Washington Post. But after that, it was, before that rather, President Eisenhower, and I try to find this document, had enlisted people to write a history of the clandestine services. Who are these people? Mm. So he hires James Doolittle, who had been a pilot during World War II in the early years of the war, 1942, was involved in the bombing of all the Japanese cities as revenge against Pearl Harbor, and he bombed many Japanese cities. James Doolittle became a great friend of D.H. Byrd, who was a great friend of Lyndon Johnson's, and Doolittle wrote a report with Dulles looking over his shoulder, and so Eisenhower reads it, and he says, this is not satisfactory, and so he hires he invites David K. E. Bruce, the famous diplomat, to write another report, and it became known as the Bruce Lovett Report. Robert Lovett was the Secretary of Defense under President Truman. You find a copy of an unredacted copy of the Bruce Lovett Report. There's a few pages redacted in Tim Weiner's Legacy of Ashes. All the good parts are missing. There are a few discussions of it in Arthur Schlesinger's biography of Bobby Kennedy called Robert Kennedy's Life and Times.
Mm.
And and you cannot find the full report. And I mean, I've tried everything. And it doesn't exist.
No,
CIA can obliterate whole libraries. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, whole libraries, people, all types of things that they have obliterated over their dark, dark history. One last thing, and this is something that I just completely forgot to get to, and I wanted to just put a little bit of focus on this to add to the character of Jim Garrison. In the movie, and again, I reference the movie because I think it's the most accessible thing to people that haven't, you know, really studied this deeply. I'm going to say that you need to pick up Jones' books on Garrison to learn about him more. But during that movie, he explains when that asset comes to speak to him about, you know, we could make arrangements so you could be a judge and all that, just as a point of reference. He comes back and says, yeah, well, during the war, I flew grasshoppers. And that thing just kind of flies by most people. But as a testament to the type of stuff this guy was made of, as a testament to the guts the guy had, Would you like to explain a little bit about...
Well, yes, in my book, I have a separate book called Jim Garrison, His Life and Times. And this is about Garrison's life independently of the Kennedy assassination, before the Kennedy investigation started. And I have a chapter on Garrison's military service. He flew, as you say, Chuck, the little grasshoppers. These are reconnaissance planes that flew into German areas. And they fought right up against German Fokker, the names are in the book, aircraft, and he was unarmed. He had just a pistol in his pocket. They were so tiny, he had to be, because he gained weight, he had to be squeezed into the plane. And he had one person with him that was sort of doing navigation. And they flew right, you know, and the Germans are flying all around them. And they evaded them. One point they had to bail out. He almost died.
The real-life Jim Garrison.
Destroyed.
The real-life Jim Garrison, by the way, when she says how large he was, how tall was he?
Jim Garrison, I guess, was 6'6".
Right. This is not a small man at all. I believe he was 6. That sounds about right. I know, and he was very tall.
He was tall and big, and he had great courage. And, in fact, the United States military awarded him an Air Medal as a result of these flights that he took and into German areas. And he was very proud of it. He kept it in his office until when he was a judge in the last years of his life, mm-hmm. Air Medal. And at the end of the war, he was part of his assignment was to fly to Dachau concentration camp a day or so after the liberation of Dachau by the Allies. And he took photographs. Jim Garrison took photographs of what he saw at Dachau. And I printed them in the book, Jim Garrison, His Life and Times. It's available on Amazon if anyone wants to know more about Jim Garrison's life. But you can see how influenced he was and how he said all that that what he saw in the concentration camps influenced him forever. So if we have to look for the origins of Jim Garrison's determination to find the truth about the Kennedy assassination, we can find it in his experiences in World War II. Now, when it came time for Korea, he was an FBI, working for the FBI, believe it or not, in the Pacific Northwest. And if you were working for the FBI, you had a choice. You could stay with the Bureau or you could go to Korea. So Garrison decided to go to Korea, and he went, and he couldn't do it. That is, the horror of war was such that he had this, I guess, what we call post-traumatic syndrome. What is it?
Post-traumatic stress disorder. Stress PTSD. Syndrome.
And he just used to be called soldier's heart in the Civil War, and shell shock in World War One.
And battle fatigue.
Battle fatigue.
Yeah, that might have been the term when he was in Korea, I think.
And he couldn't do it, so he went to the hospital and so forth, and that ended his very short career with the FBI. But he did have a career. He was a perfectly conventional man at that time. And he came back and he wanted to be a writer, and he started submitting short stories, and he started writing books, and he did finally publish, we should add, 3 books, Heritage of Stone, and then his novel, The Star-Spangled Contract, and then his memoir, the final memoir, On the Trail of the Assassins, that Oliver Stone used for the film JFK. I think that Oliver Stone did Garrison a great service. Garrison was too ill to see the film. He was sent a cassette, and they put it on, and his friend, Judge Gulotta, Jimmy Gulotta, who was a friend to the end of his life, had been a classmate at Tulane, was there, and he said, Gulotta told me that he couldn't focus on it. It was too late. But it didn't really make any difference. He didn't care. Garrison didn't care when the House Select Committee collapsed, when they said it was the mafia, when they disrespected his investigation. He just kept saying, and the Louisiana investigators, L.J. Delsa and Bob Uris, were horrified with what the U.S. government was doing, what Blakey was doing. Mm-hmm. And Garrison said, don't worry, the truth will come out.
That's true. And about those pictures that he took in Germany, he kept them in an album, actually, right?
Yes, he kept it was a homemade album that Garrison made. And these pictures that he took at Dachau were always by his side. He kept it close to him his whole life. It's very touching, and kind of it shows that he was really a very simple man, a kind of innocent man, which is how come so many plants and CIA people and nefarious individuals made their way into his office and became part of the investigation. It was extreme, and also partly it was because he didn't have any money. This was very, there was a group called Truth and Consequences and all that, but right. They didn't have much money. They had to really wing it, and he had very few investigators working. And so he allowed people to come in. But he said at one point in a letter to Zach Sklar, who was the screenwriter for JFK, I'm very naive. I'm easily fooled. I'm naive, and I'm very easily fooled.
Well, at the end of his life also, it's my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but at the end of his life, I believe he even remarried his wife,
Wasn't his idea. Don't get too romantic, Chuck, because it was one of the judges on the court, mm-hmm. where Garrison was in the court, the Court of Appeal, said, listen, what will happen to your pension when you die? Mm-hmm. And then Judge Tom Early, who was a friend of Garrison's, also pressured him to remarry Liz. And Garrison replied, you marry Liz. It was this type of humor. And finally, the children pressured, and finally he did it, and he gave in and remarried Liz so that she could have the pension. But it wasn't his – I just don't want – I kind of have the feeling it's better to look at the realities, not the illusions. It's always – this is history now. This is – we can't afford to – I don't know. I feel that way about Garrison's extramarital life. I don't think it had anything to do with his work on the Kennedy assassination, just as I don't agree with Cy Hirsch, who said that somehow John F. Kennedy's decision-making was influenced by his womanizing and promiscuous behavior. I don't think it had anything to do. I think that it had no influence on it at all, but that he was a kind of serial I don't know what's the word. I can't think of the word. It's late at night now.
Adulterer, possibly.
Well, you know, he was he had to have women, many different women all the time. And the great line of Nora Ephron is not an exaggeration. She said, "I was the only White House intern he didn't hit on." That doesn't mean it changes his policies or his value historically, but that's just the complete picture. And if we lie about any one thing, we're going to lie about another thing. You can't be trusted to anything that you say if you cover up what's so well known.
Absolutely true. And I just love the fact that we could go into all this and examine, you know, the texture of a character. And we didn't really cover it in depth, but if you want to understand this character, if you want to understand this man, if you want to understand the context of what was going on, I definitely urge you to pick up at the very least as a starting point the two books that that Joan wrote about Garrison, which Joan, they were A Farewell to Justice, which has just been reissued with the extra 90 pages in it, and
and the other book is called Jim Garrison, His Life and Times, and so those are both in paperback, both available on Amazon. And the reissue of A Farewell to Justice is published by Skyhorse. And on the cover, I deliberately put Perry Russo, Garrison's chief witness, because I wanted to say that despite all the efforts to undermine Russo's testimony, they failed, and he was telling the truth.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you also wrote the book on DeMorin Shields. Go ahead. Mention all
this. The other book is called about George DeMorin Shield, who was Lee Harvey Oswald's handler in Dallas and Fort Worth, and it's called Our Man in Haiti, George DeMorin Shield, CIA, and there's a In the Nightmare Republic. I took that from Graham Greene because I wanted to have two quotes from Graham Greene in the title. Our Man in Haiti, of course, relates to Our Man in Havana, and In the Nightmare Republic, and that's a phrase in Graham Greene's novel, The Comedians, that he uses to describe Haiti, and it has been indeed a nightmare republic. Haitians may not like to see that, but I think that's really what it was. And there was George DeMorin Shield doing in Haiti what he was doing with Oswald, and that is working for CIA.
Right, and also The Great Game in Cuba.
The Great Game in Cuba is about how CIA thwarted its own plan to unseat Fidel Castro. And that book is partly about Texas, partly about Robert J. Clayburgh Jr., a lot about Cuba, a lot about CIA, and about takes the point of view of Cubans who wanted their country back. It's an unusual point of view for me, but why not? And I had a marvelous source in Alberto Fernandez, and who really told me his story, that, and also the story of Humberto Sori Marin, who was wanting a different Cuba from the one that Fidel Castro created.
Right. I was particularly impressed with the book on Haiti, by the way, with all the background information. I learned so much and never knew all that, you know, about how Haiti had evolved. But also Joan has written books on, Bobby Knight, film. I mean, there's all you're a prolific writer.
I wrote biographies, and I think they all prepared for writing about Garrison. I wrote biography of a writer called Kay Boyle, and a dual biography of Lillian Hellman, the playwright, and Dashiell Hammett, the detective story writer. And that was very useful in learning how to write somebody's life story. How do you do that? And how to bring in, especially political people like Hellman and Hammett, how to bring the political views in and incorporate it into the story of their lives.
Right. So we are just about out of time, but before I go, I want to make sure that you guys take a look at Joan's stuff. You can find her on Amazon.com. You can look for her at JoanMellon.com. You can always catch me now because this was show number one, but the Ocelli Effect will be on UCY every Saturday night. Catch you next time.
The age of 19 in 1962, she was a...
See, but I have the files. You know, I read this
really?
Book in the National Archives, and I read these other things.
I said to myself,
how
can
that be possible for him? You know,
all
the characters and the bottles of choice and on the internet, professional wrestlers, and not just Ventura style.
It doesn't matter where the incarnation
comes from, as long as it's real. It doesn't, it's hard to get real in this nation.